was going through some things the other day, and I found some pictures that were really interesting. These are aerial drone photos, and apparently somebody took them. This doesn't look like somewhere in the United States, but it's interesting because they're a diverse set of photos. And you can see, as you look at them, something looks very much like it's in the middle of summer, and something looks like it's very much in the middle of winter. And it's an interesting way. Now, this one looks a little bit different. It looks like fall and winter as well. And then this is kind of a little bit of fall, a little bit of winter, and a little bit of summer or spring maybe wrapped into all of that. And it was mindful to me as I was going through and preparing that the Psalms are in the same way, that though obviously the person that took these photos took them over a period of months perhaps and sent their what I suspect is a drone photo, drone up above this landscape and would take them maybe once in December, maybe once in July, or maybe once in October, and then maybe once in February, and lay them across next to each other. The reality is when we encounter the Psalms, when we engage with the Psalms, we recognize that they are in many ways different things that are layered next to each other with very different expressions. Just like we recognize that this probably isn't an accurate just one-shot picture, but rather that it's a picture laid in with another picture, the Psalms themselves do the same thing. They lay themselves in with each other. So you'll read one psalm, and then you'll go to the next psalm, and it'll be a very different kind of psalm. And that's a reality of how this book is constructed. And that's something that I was mindful of while I was preparing this sort of for our time here tonight. The Psalms are a unique book, but they're a book that we really are able to get into, and we're going to talk a little bit about them tonight. You'll notice on the handout, I'll have a number of the things that are up on the screen will be on the handout, but there will be a couple other things up on the screen that aren't on the handout. On the back, if you choose, so choose, I've left some space on the back. We're going to try to use our time wisely and dig into four Psalms specifically that are unique Psalms. And with all of this, we wanted to be able to take our conversation from last week, where we had left off with the Psalms, and then take our conversation from last week, having discussed the genre of Psalms, having discussed some of the structure of the book, how the book had maybe come together, and so forth, that we wanted to take that conversation and then extend it to finish out sort of an overview of the book of Psalms. Psalms is one of the books that we encounter that is really a diverse book. And this throughout this semester, throughout the spring, we're going to be talking about wisdom literature in the Old Testament. And the Psalms fit into the wisdom literature category at points, though not entirely. Their wisdom literature is kind of a, we gave a definition last week that wisdom literature has to do with instruction for life. It presents to us stories, or maybe not stories, it presents to us language that's supposed to challenge us, supposed to encourage us, that's supposed to give us an example of how we are to live. Psalms does this at points, but not entirely. So it doesn't fit in all that well. One of the reasons is that the book of Psalms represents perhaps the most diverse book in the Bible in terms of literature, focus, topics, theology, and we could just keep going and going, and I did not keep going and going, but we could keep going and going, and any number of other issues that happen in there. At the heart of Psalms, at the heart of Psalms, which we'll get into, is that it was this book that was put together to be something quite something amazing with that. Calvin said this about the Psalms, we must have songs not only honorable but also holy, which are to be like needles to arouse us to prayer and praise God, to meditate on His works in order to love Him, fear, honor, and glorify Him. We will not find better songs nor ones more appropriate for this purpose than the Psalms of David, which the Holy Spirit has spoken to him and made. Therefore, when we sing them, we are certain that God has put His words in the mouth, our mouth, as if they themselves sang in us to exalt His glory. And that comes from John Calvin in 1542 from his book, The Forms and Prayers and Songs of Church. And what happened was, it's a reminder that the Book of Psalms, in so many ways, and the Reformation Church represented their songbook. There's a funny little story about Calvin that he, as he was creating the songbook for the Reformed Church, one of the things that he did is he ended up sending his musicians into the local pubs and bars in Geneva and said, take the tunes that they're playing and we'll set them alongside this text of Psalms. So what they would do is they would take a psalm and they'd put it on top of an old bar tune or something like that. This was actually the pattern of how they constructed a lot of the early worship from the Reformation Church, I should say. Luther had his own little thing, and he had a lot of stuff to say about the Psalms. He thought Hebrew, Luther did, he thought Hebrew was the most poetic of the biblical languages. It was the most beautiful of the biblical languages, which is intriguing. And but he would, Luther had a little bit different way that he went about the worship in his wing of the church. In Calvin's Reformed wing, which arises in Geneva, that's kind of how they went about it. Now, this pattern persists, and the Book of Psalms becomes the song book of so much of what happens in Christianity, even through the early period of the colonial period in America, that they would distribute psalms and they would sing them most of the time in colonial churches a cappella. If they walked in, if a colonial happened to, which time travel is impossible, but if they were able to come into our time and they saw something like this, they would be astounded. Because they wouldn't have often had, excuse me, a facility much like this at all. But they would use the Psalms and so forth to use that as kind of the work of the literature. Kind of talked about this last week. I didn't have a good example last week, but I got a good one this week. This is kind of the way the books of the Bible is set out. And this is probably the clearest one I could find with the most color. You'll see that you've got kind of a bookshelf of the books of the Bible, and there's some really specific reasons why things are the way that they are. And you'll see, let's see if I can get into it here. I don't want to do that. Hold on. It keeps going. Here we go. Let me see if I can get into this. No, I don't want to do that. Stop that. Okay, here we go. No, stop that. No, I don't want to do that either. I'm trying to get my stylus to work. Maybe I need to go over here and do it. Yeah, I just do it. I'll pick it up here. Let's try this. So you'll see that you've got a couple of things. You got the books of Genesis right there. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. That's the Pentateuch, the first five books. And then all the way across here through the book of Esther, you have kind of that the history of Israel that happens. And that, for the most part, is chronological. Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther. Esther is challenging just because of where it's located, but Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther kind of on the back end. Ezra and Nehemiah dovetail each other in some interesting ways down here. But then you get into this. This is what we've been talking about a lot. These are the what this calls the books of poetry, but starting with the book of Job, you also have Psalms. We would call a lot of this wisdom literature, and this are really the books that we're going to be surveying for the rest of this semester. So it's this right here. Then you get into the major prophets, the minor prophets are here, then you get into the New Testament, Acts kind of sits on its own as a history book, then you get into Paul's epistles all the way from Romans to Philemon, then what we call the general epistles, or the Catholic epistles, which begin in Hebrews, end up in Jude. Some people put Revelation as an epistle because it kind of had this notion that it was a circular letter. Who are the churches that it was written to? The seven churches of Asia Minor. Now, you don't have to do that. I actually put the book of Revelation out on its own. I'd put it over here, kind of in its own category. We had a long conversation about that about a year or so ago. Talking about Revelation as apocalyptic literature or eschatological literature and so forth. The other thing, and this is for anybody because I know we have a lot of engineers or STEM folks, this is the books of the Bible if you wanted to lay them out on a periodic table. kind of maybe gives you a good breakdown of what they are and maybe helps encourage you in that way of being in the STEM field or something, but it's kind of the same thing. You'll see you've got the first five up here. You got the first five up here, but nevertheless, and then so forth. We see how that all works out. Now, I mentioned last week, and this is one of the things I wanted to bring up, that this is the order of the books of the Bible that we are all used to. Genesis begins at Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, Ruth, 1st, 2nd Samuel, 1st, 2nd Kings, 1st, 2nd Chronicles, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Job, Psalms, yada, yada, yada. For particularly the Old Testament, we're used to this order. This is the Christian order of the books of the Old Testament, which you grew up perhaps using those. But not all of our church members would have grown up using these. We would have used the Hebrew set of the books of the Bible. And what becomes intriguing about this is that you'll see that it's a little bit different in how it's set up. Now, you have Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. Again, the first five books, they would call that the five books of the law. And then you have your normal Joshua, Judges, 1st, 2nd Samuel, 1st, 2nd Kings. Now, this is all the same that you and I would be familiar with. Then things change. Now, this is the Jewish set, or how the Hebrew Bible would set this up. I have in my study here, I have a Hebrew Bible called, it's just the Biblia Hebraica Stuttgartensia, 4th edition and a 3rd edition, and it's on my shelf. It's the Hebrew Bible. And what it does, though, is it follows the order like this, because it's published by Jewish Institute. And then you'll notice what they do after, they call them the former prophets, it's actually the history books, but what they'll do is they'll put these in really specific categories. This is the whole thing is, this is the Torah here, this is the Nevi'im here, and this is the Ketuvim here. So it's Tanakh, or Tank, or Tanakh, and it'll be, let me see if I can do this, I don't think I can. You would see, it's not going to give me completely what I want. It'll be the Tanakh, and you'd have two A's, because Hebrew is a consonant-based language. But you'll have then Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and the 12 minor prophets. But then you get into the writings, and notice what happens. Whereas we would normally have stuff right here, they move all of this over here. So Psalms leads in, and then you have Job, Proverbs, Ruth, Song of Songs, Ecclesiastes. Notice, isn't it interesting that Ruth is here and Ruth isn't here? That's really intriguing to me. Joshua Judges, Ruth, right here. Song of Songs is in there and Ecclesiastes. And then you get into the later writings, and the reason for this is because the language of the later writings comes from after the exile. And that changes, the exile changes everything for what was left of Israel, really just Judah at that point. Benjamin was in there too, but they're too small. Lamentations leads off the post-exilic writings, followed by Esther. Daniel's in there. Now, where would you expect to see Daniel? With the major prophets. Daniel is generally considered to be a major prophet. Lamentations should go right over here after Jeremiah. Ezra and Nehemiah should go, somewhere around in here. Probably before Saul, before Job. But then the really critical one here, right here, is 1st and 2nd Chronicles. 1st and 2nd Chronicles ends the Jewish layout of the Old Testament. So just give you an example of that. The other thing that we run into is we have some differences in verse numbering. But that's just a minor thing. So you see with all of this that we have a different form in how it's set up. But at the center of all of this continues to be the book of Psalms. Psalms occupies kind of here, even though it's a writing, it occupies its own category. We're using it to talk about wisdom literature because we think wisdom literature is somewhat contained in Psalms, though not completely. Plus, it's nice to be able to walk through and talk about some Psalms because everybody likes the book of Psalms. I don't know anybody that said anything bad about the book of Psalms. Do you? I know people that said really bad stuff about the book of James, but not the book of Psalms. Psalms are everybody's friend. So Or Ecclesiastes. Well, that's what happens when you get a teenager to write something. But so anyways, at the heart of wisdom literature in the Old Testament is the idea of Hebrew poetry. And this is one of the things that we want to get into. Now, what are some famous poems that you know of in English? Poems. The Midnight Ride of Paul Revere. 'Twas 18th of April in 75. Hardly a man is still alive that can remember that famous day and year. Yeah, I remember that one. What else? Lots of Shakespeare sonnets. Yeah, absolutely. Tried to use Shakespeare sonnets to woo a girl while I was in seminary. Didn't work. The Road Less Traveled. The Road Not Taken by Robert Frost. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both, and be one traveler long I stood. And I looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth, and then the other, and then took the other just as fair, and having perhaps a better calm or better claim because it was grassy and wanted to wear. So you get into the idea, there's some meter in there. What are some components of English poetry? Meter is one of them. A little bit in English, not as much as in other forms, but what else? What other facets in English poetry? Rhyme, yeah. Pentameter, iambic pentameter, trochaic pentameter, all those kinds of fun things that you had to learn while you were in school. And some of us, others. But nevertheless, I mean, you run it. So English poetry, we have some very specific understandings of it. We look at something and we're like, oh yeah, that's poetry because it's set in a certain way. Well, Hebrew poetry is very different from English poetry. Really, there are two key types. One has to do with parallelism, and then the other has to do with meter. Now, meter is harder for us to see. Why is that? Why is meter harder for us to see? Because of translation, yeah. Not only are we moving from an inflected language to a non-inflected language, not only are we moving from a completely different vocalization to what we have now, not only are we moving from reading left to right to left, not only are we moving from having vowels to having only consonants, we're also talking about a language that's been dead for about 2,000 years. We don't really know what ancient Hebrew sounded like. We think we know. We're just not entirely sure. So, Hebrew poetry is unique from English versions, and we've talked a little bit about that already. Often, English poetry has a specific formatting to let you know it is poetry. Hebrew poetry doesn't do this. So when you're reading along and you'll pick up a book of poems, we don't write a lot of books on poetry anymore either, do we? But you pick up a book on poems, you're going to know that it's going to follow a very specific pattern. What was E.E. Cummings' pattern for poetry? Does anybody remember? Yeah, he never used capital letters. That's correct. Absolutely. Little things that you do. Sometimes poetry rhymes, sometimes it doesn't. I remember learning a lot about that. Believe it or not, here's a fun fact. It'll come up on the quiz. I was president of the Creative Writing Club while I was in high school, and we had a lot of aspiring poets that would come and deliver their soliloquies or their group or their assignments and all that stuff. It was so interesting to listen to hear where they put their different emphasis and what they did to plumb that. Hebrew poetry is a lot different than what we expect because Hebrew poetry doesn't inherently follow the English form. It doesn't need to. Now, sometimes you'll be going through your Bibles and you'll be going through your Old Testament, which is where the Hebrew is, and you'll look through the Old Testament and you'll see a lot of, let me get my stuff out of here so it doesn't all fall out. You'll run into a lot of stuff that looks like it's just prose. Now, prose is pretty simple. It just kind of goes back and forth. It has paragraph format and so forth. And you run into that. The challenge is when you run into poetry, it begins something different. They set it in a little bit different. They take returns or they go back in with the line. A new line starts at an earlier point. It doesn't have justification on the left side and so forth. So we have a tendency to note where poetry is, and sometimes we miss it. Now, one of the arguments about Genesis 1, and this is one of the things you'll hear occasionally when people start talking about creation, you'll start talking about the nature of Genesis 1:1 through 2:3, which is the first creation account. Some people will sit there and say, well, we don't have to take it because it's poetry. Well, it's not entirely poetry. Most of it's prose. There is a very small section or two, a couple verses within that first creation account that are actually poetic. But that doesn't mean that they're allegorical. It doesn't mean that they're figurative only. Hebrew poetry doesn't function that way. Now, granted, one of the challenges of Hebrew poetry is that all of prophetic literature in the Old Testament is in poetic format or uses some kind of poetry in there. So poetry is important to know because the Book of Psalms is a book that uses poetry quite a lot. Now, there are some key types of Hebrew poetry. I mentioned those already. It flows the same as everything else on the old scrolls. Now, when I go and I pick up my BHS, let me show you here real quick. Actually, let me just go ahead and show you. Why talk about it when I can show you? Don't want to do that. So I pick up the old BHS. I'm going to run it up on the screen here in a second as soon as it loads. I'll just pull up something and maybe we can... All right. Okay, here's Genesis chapter... Which way am I going? Here am I going. So this is Genesis chapter 1. Can you see that okay? All right. Let me get it bigger. Let's see if I can get it bigger. I'm having to use the screen back there. Okay. All right. Yeah, I can make it bigger though. Here we go. So this is Genesis chapter 1. That's too big. I need to be able to show you guys what's going on. This is Genesis chapter 1. The left side, the right side of the screen, this side over here is poetry. Or not poetry, excuse me, that's the Hebrew. That's not going to justify better. Okay. So anyway, so this is like how it's all set up in terms of prose. So in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Then you go through and you'll see that it's fairly well set up this way. Now, all these little dots and so forth here, that's all the vowel pointing. So you see that it really goes through with that. But let's kick down to the book of Job. Job 1:1. So this is Job. Now, the book of Job is in poetic format, we believe. However, it depends on the translation and what you've chosen to do. So you see that it's all still in very much that prose format. Now you'll notice, now in case you're unfamiliar, the English on the left side we read this way, the Hebrew on this side we read this way. So instead of being left to right, it's right to left. So you'll run into that with it. Now, the book of Job is probably a poetic book. Some parts of it a little bit more than others. Let me see. Here we go. Here's something interesting. So you'll notice here, so this is Job 6:28. You'll notice the Hebrew doesn't change in its formatting. It's still going on prose. But the English translators have sought to set this in as some kind of poetic kind of stanza. So you'll get that occasionally. Let's run over to the book of Psalms. Yeah, go for it. I'm going to just kick over to Psalms real quick. Yeah. I'm sorry. By prose, I mean it has narrative functions to it. It has.
That's why I'm asking prose or poetic literature. Just because it's in that form, does that mean it's not narrative?
It does not inherently mean that. No, not necessarily. What's one of the more so in Greece, for instance, ancient Greece, the Odyssey that was written by Homer. That's complete poetry. It's in Greek, but it's in complete poetry. But it's still, I guess that's a figurative thing. But you'll run into that occasionally, and so forth. I think I answered your question. Did I answer your question?
Well, I think you said it can be both. It can be narrative and prose.
Yeah. I think that's what I said. It can be both. Yes, it can be. So what you'll see here, and I'll do this real quick, and then we'll get kicked back in. This is a happy diversion. We've been watching Richard Ross, by the way, at home, occasionally the painter, remember him with the happy little tree and all that kind of stuff. He's got a whole channel on your Roku sticks. It's amazing. You can watch like 40 hours of them. and then you're still halfway through. It's amazing. Anyways, so you'll see that you'll run into this. This is Psalms chapter 1, and you'll see it's kind of the same format. It's kind of the same setting. So they don't really, in Hebrew, they don't make those distinctions. While we have this set in, the wicked are not like this. Instead, they are like chaff of the wind. Here in verse 4, verse 4 follows a fairly straightforward pathway. So they don't reflect it, I'm saying, as we do in English. It's not the way that Hebrew poetry inherently functions. Of course, a lot of this stuff at this point is still going to be the decision of the interpreter. If I can help with that. So anyways, that's probably a little bit of a diversion, but it's, I think, a worthy one. At the heart of Hebrew wisdom literature in the Old Testament is the idea of Hebrew poetry. I already did that. So talk about parallelism real quick. There are a number of different kinds of parallelism that you'll encounter. And what I like to do, I'm going to sort of grace through these pretty quick. I'll let you look at them a little bit more in depth because I provided some examples of those for you. And hopefully they'll be encouraging to you. You'll see the first one, which is probably something that happens quite often, is synonymous parallelism. This is a repeated idea. And you'll see this in Psalm 33, 10 through 11. The Lord frustrates the counsel of the nations, and he thwarts the plans of the peoples. The counsel of the Lord stands forever. The plans of his heart from generation to generation. There's a repeated idea that exists there. It's what is the action of the Lord? What is the result of the Lord? The action of the Lord is this. The result of the Lord is that. Antithetic parallelism is the idea of contrasting ideas. We see that here in Psalm 35. For his anger only lasts only a moment, but his favor a lifetime. Weeping may stay overnight, but there is joy in the morning. And what you can see here between these concepts is something fairly straightforward. You'll notice that right here you have the word anger, but then you have the word favor. That's that parallelism that we're talking about. Here you have weeping that stays overnight, but then the joy comes when? In the morning. These are contrasting ideas. This is the way that the person who wrote this psalm found a way to express that. Grammatical parallelism, these are individual words over lines. Sacrifice is pleasing to God. The sacrifice pleasing to God is a broken spirit. You will not despise a broken and humbled heart, God. You'll notice the words there for broken. The word particularly, they use two different kinds. Now, this is harder for us to see in English because the word broken that's used, that I've underlined here twice, it's the exact same word. But guess what? In Hebrew, it isn't. It's two very different words. And what this word is, this first word right here, is this idea of broken, is in broken, it uses a feminine context. And this version of broken down here uses a masculine context. So what the author is doing is he's showing kind of a parallelism grammatically to try to bring emphasis, try to separate these two lines for emphasis. Yes? It could be because of that. What's interesting is that the word broken, as it exists, the broken spirit and the broken heart, it would be brokenness is a verb describing spirit, and then brokenness describing heart. So it would be two different words that go in there. It's a good concept to ask about. But I would suspect, in the way that I looked at it when I was looking at the material, it is that these inherently carry different genders in order to draw in that parallelism, that the author is being intentional about this and so forth. It's a good question, though, with that and so forth. So syntactical parallelism is the structure of the sentence. Notice this, I will bless the Lord at all times. His praise will always be on my lips. Blessing, the idea of I will bless, and then his praise, where that all comes into. And I didn't get my pointer thing out. The lexical parallelism here, which wraps us out, word pairs to show contrast. And what I've done here, I've pointed out the word called. In the first line, I called to the Lord in my distress, and I cried to God for help. So I called to God, and then I cried to God. So again, the words that are used there, that's the one thing that we run into again and again in the book of Psalms is, one, we always want to be really careful about the words that are used. Words are in short supply whenever we encounter Scripture. And a word that's there has probably been placed there very specifically when it comes to the Psalms. Because when we look at how they were created, how they developed, how they were pulled together, there's some really specific examples that we can learn. So that idea of called versus cried. I called out to God in my distress. I cried to the Lord for help. That repetition with a growing emphasis exists to try to draw in some kind of attention. So we see this a lot in Psalms. These are all good examples. A couple ways to recognize Hebrew poetry. I'm not going to spend a ton of time on this. Parallelism, which is what we've talked about. The terseness of words. Is the author being kind of terse? Are they being short? Are they being kind of direct? The use of word pairs, the use of rhythm, an unusual word order. Now, this is harder for us to see in the English because a lot of times translators kind of try to make it not sound like Yoda. But a lot of times in Hebrew, the Hebrew can sound like Yoda, which is all of our favorite, your favorite character of Star Wars it is. Nevertheless, the challenge, you can have some unusual word order. Unusual vocabulary, including archaisms. That's sort of, again, a little bit harder for us because, again, in the English translation, English translations are all very good. They have a tendency to gloss over these. But if it's the same thing, so I'm using the CSB right here. If I pick up the CSB and I go to John 3:16, it's going to say John 3:16 differently than the King James Version would. Why is that? Does anybody know? Let me read for you. Let me read this to you here real quick. So I go to John 3:16, and this, it is, "For God loved the world in this way, he gave his one and only Son, so that everyone who believes in him will not perish but have eternal life." Well, that sounds pretty normal. Sounds like something you and I would say. What does the King James say? "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever shall believeth in him shall not perish, but have eternal life." We already see some archaisms in the King James, don't we? Because we speak modern English. What's one of those words that would have been archaic? Begotten? Anytime you get a th on the end of a word, believeth, thou, thee, thus. I mean, those are archaisms. You'll run into that in Hebrew. My encouragement for you, if you want to get a little bit deeper in that, go learn Hebrew. Ask Dr. Laufer. He has his PhD in Old Testament. I do not. So, see, it's a deft move. And then also the concentration of figurative language. If you see a lot of figurative language coming up, metaphor, simile, exchanging plain words for something a bit more figurative, that really works in there as well. And you'll see that. That's one way to recognize Hebrew poetry. Now, that's particularly if you're going through maybe non-poetic books. You're going through Chronicles, you're going through Kings, or you're going through, you know, Judges or something like that. That's one of the ways to run into that. But anyways, I don't want to wear us out on that and so forth. That I hear, okay. Let me jump through this. Now, one of the things that we talked about last week, but we didn't get to, are the titles of the Psalms. And I think this is an important thing because titles, we'll see them often. Now, the challenge is, a lot of times when we're flipping through our Bibles, and if you have your Bible with you, start going to some Psalms, and you'll start seeing they're already labeled. Now, what's different, though, is that sometimes there are titles in a Psalm that are embedded into the actual Hebrew. So 116 Psalms have titles. Out of 115, that's a pretty good number. So we see that often part of the Hebrew text, it also forms part of the canonical text of a psalm. So this is the kind of text that has been transferred from psalm to psalm to psalm to psalm. So it's actually in the Hebrew. Now, I say this, let me go and I'll give you an example of one. See if I can find a good one. Yeah, so in Psalm 57. So, well, you know what? Actually, let me just go to one of the ones I have up. Here we go. This one right here. This is Psalm 23. We're going to look at Psalm 23 here in a minute, but I'll look at it right now. So so this you see, Psalm 23. Now, right up top here, this is the title of the psalm. And what's that title say? A Psalm of David. This is actually in the Hebrew. So if we were to go to Psalm 23 in the Hebrew, it would say a Psalm of David. Now, what does that mean? Did David write it? Maybe. He commissioned it? He paid for it? I mean, that happens a lot today.
He did it when he was with Saul.
Okay, that's a possibility. This is a Psalm of David. So all that to say, it's a title for the psalm. Now, when I go to Psalm 23 in my script, in my Bible, let me go to it here real quick. Psalm 23, my Bible, it says, the Good Shepherd in bold print. But that's not the title, is it? No, that's the title that the translators gave to it. But then right below it in italics, it says a Psalm of David. If you have a Bible with you, what is Psalm 23? What did they call it in your Bible? A Psalm of David. Does it have a header on top of that?
The Lord, the Psalmist Shepherd.
The Lord, the Psalmist Shepherd. Okay, what else? It might be in bold print over top of a Psalm of David. Do you have anything else? And some of them don't add anything to, by the way. That's not uncommon. One of the things translators do is they try to make a differentiation. So for me, in my translation here, the Good Shepherd is all in caps and it's bolded. But a Psalm of David, which we've seen again right here, it's in italics. And it is, the word, the P in Psalm is not capitalized. So they kind of set it out to let you know this could be a title and so forth. Going back to our discussion over here. Okay. There are five types of classifications of titles. One, they identify a group, a person, or a group. And some examples, again, these aren't exhaustive. If you want something exhaustive, I can scan the book that I copied these from and send it to you. This is Psalms 3, 72, and 90. They identify a person or a group. Conveys historical information, Psalm 18 or Psalm 34. Let me look and see what Psalm 34 is saying here. This is what Psalm 34's title is. Concerning David, when he pretended to be insane in the presence of Abimelech, who drove him out and he departed. That's some historical information. This is a psalm about David when he was acting nuts. So it's a fun way to look at it. They also can contain moral information. They can contain moral information. Let me flip over here to Psalm 4. For the choir director with stringed instruments, a psalm of David. Probably not the best moral information. They could contain a liturgical information as well, and so forth. So you'll run into these where they give you some information. A Psalm of David for remembrance. This is a liturgical psalm from Psalm 38. And then also designate the type of psalm. They designate the type of psalm. So as we saw before in 32, a Psalm of David. In Psalm 120, we'll flip over there real quick. Psalm 120. This is fun. I bought this Bible like a couple months ago and it's still not completely, pages are still stuck together. Psalm 120, a song of accents. So this is a psalm that's going to be accented. We're going to listen. There's something very specific. I'm sorry, you're right, ascent. You're right. I looked at accent. I saw two C's. Ascents, a song of ascents. This is the idea of song of praise. That's right. And the header for me is a cry for truth and peace is what they said about it. So very good, yeah. Very good. So we see that there's a lot of different titles in Psalms. The titles in Psalms allow us to see how that psalm has worked itself out, what's going on with it. Maybe gives us some information. That title is contained within the Hebrew text. This is very unique for us, and you don't find this in a lot of other places. When you're going through the book of Proverbs, we'll run into this occasionally, but we won't run into it very often. But yeah.
Okay,
Absolutely. There are some good commentaries on Psalms, and they will all give you their opinion. It is rare that we, and this is the challenge of biblical studies, the text is so separated from where we are. I mean, and I don't mean that in a negative way, it's just so distanced. I hear people all the time talking about, it's like one of the things I run into a lot, I hear folks talking about the salvific condition of somebody who's a very public figure. I'm like, you don't know that person. You only know that person through television, which is an exchange. You don't know that person. You don't know how they are, who they are, how, where they are. I mean, we can go down the line. I mean, I've ran into Christian leaders a lot that I see on TV all the time, and then you run into them in their regular life, and you're like, wow, that's interesting. I mean, it's just a challenge. The text of Psalms is so distant from us. And all that to say, it's so distant from us, it's hard for us to get to know exactly where it is. Now, we do know, and because the way that the text has developed since it was initially probably created, it's like any songs that we have today. You look at the hymns that we have in the hymn book. I don't know if you ever have done that on a Sunday. Maybe you're waiting for service to get going or something like that, and you grab a hymn book and you start looking through, and you'll see the notes on the page. You'll see all the lines and the songs, but then you'll see some funny information, like this is sung to the tune of da-da-da-da-da-da. And then you'll have some numbers like 4, 5, 3, 2 or something like that. So in the Baptist hymnal that we have, which is right here, yeah, so here's, Brethren, we have met to worship. And it gives you the entire, you know, it's the hymn all the way through. But then the really interesting information is down here at the bottom, because you get the words and the music. And you'll see that this, it's the tune is Holy Manna. And then it uses 8787D, and that lets you know, I used to know this a lot better than I do. It gives you the meter of the different verses. And what you can do is you could take Brethren, the words of Brethren, we have come to worship. Let's see if I can find it. I used to be able to do this. We had a whole seminary course on this, believe it or not, because they assumed we would go into churches where we would all pick up the hymnal and sing these ways. We will look. We can look at that a little later. We see that these are the first lines. Anyways, I don't know this hymnal as well as I should, so I probably shouldn't have picked it up. But anyways, what you can do is you can find a corresponding psalm or a corresponding song that uses the tune Holy Manna. And what you'll be able to do is you can lay the text of Brethren, We Have Come to Worship over top the other tune, or over top the other hymn, and you can sing it. Well, it'll sound different. It's like singing Amazing Grace to House of the Rising Sun, which actually happened, by the way. Blind Boys of Alabama, which is a great group, the gospel group, they actually took the Amazing Grace, and they just sang it to the tune for the House of the Rising Sun on one of their albums. It's kind of fun. But it's kind of that same thing. So there's a lot of data in the hymn book. The challenge is we don't have that same data in the Hebrew, but we have clues. And the commentators are really, really, especially the technical ones. These commentators that write kind of like the not that these are bad commentaries, they just have a different purpose. Kind of like the application commentaries or the illustration commentaries or preaching the word. They have a different purpose. They're more geared towards lay people. They're more geared toward the laity. They're more geared towards non-technical, non-trained folks. The more technical commentaries, like I had in here last week, I mean, they're going to get into some of that. The Word Biblical Commentary is going to get into some of that stuff. The NICOT, the New International Commentary on the Old Testament, is going to get into some of that. And you'll learn some of that. The challenge is we just don't have enough data. So nevertheless, let's look at Psalm 23 real quick. So again, I've got the words up here, and what we can do, I want to look through this and just kind of give you an approach. Maybe we can do this and maybe one or two others if we can get to them. Kind of, how do you dig into the Psalms? How do you take your Bible and you go through it and you see Psalms and you're like, the Lord is my shepherd, I have what I need. He lets me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He renews my life. He leads me along the path, the right path, for his name's sake. When I go through the darkest valley, I fear no danger, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Only goodness and faithful love will pursue me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord as long as I live. So one of the things that we see, there's a lot laid into this psalm. So we recognize that just because we have the words on the page, that's important, but it's not the totality of what we have. So we go into here. Notice, again, we already talked a little bit about this. Right at the top is the title, A Psalm of David. Almost universally, Psalm 23 is recognized as a Davidic psalm. The other thing that we see about this, this is a trust psalm. This is a trust psalm. That is the theme of it. And listen, doesn't it sound like trust? The Lord is my shepherd. Now, I know that in the modern era, we found out that people don't like being called sheep. They didn't in the medieval period either, but the illustration still exists. The Lord is my shepherd. How many of you have run into a sheep herd or heard a sheep walking around with a shepherd? Yeah. Have you interacted with sheep very much? Here's a fun thing. Go ask my wife on a Sunday how it was showing sheep, because she was in 4-H growing up and she showed sheep. And she'll tell you they were dumber than my husband, which is a real accomplishment for a sheep. And they stink. Yeah, they don't know where they're going. You got to help them. You got to lead them. You got to do the thing. But notice this, but it's that idea of trust, protection. Other trust psalms include Psalm 11, Psalm 16, Psalm 91, Psalm 121, 125, 129, 131. There's a couple more. But notice the two sections in here. Now, there are two distinct sections. One is this, and the second is this. Now, we've already broken these two sections down in the text. Verses 1 through 4 talks about the caring shepherd. It talks about the caring shepherd. I'm not going to try to write because it just isn't going to work as well as I thought it should. But this is the caring shepherd. The other thing that we run into is that the second part has to do with being God being a host. So that first part is about being a shepherd. The second part is about being a host. I'm sorry? I probably grabbed just the first couple because I wanted to make... No, this is six. There's only six. Yeah, I'm looking at it right here. There's six. Yeah, so Lord, this only has six verses to it. So you'll see it has two distinct parts and it's two distinct metaphors. One, the first one, which is God as shepherd. The second one, which is God as host. When you go over to somebody's house and they cook you dinner and they take care of you, there's another trust aspect to that. Notice how the metaphor changes across the two. We go from being a shepherd, sharing, being cared for by God as a shepherd, to being hosted by God as an affectionate person. When you go into somebody's house, which I know we don't always do as much as we used to, but when you go into their house, you're cared for. They've cooked you a meal. They bring you into the warmth of their house. There's something very hospitable about that. And there's something very different. Notice how the psalmist describes it, probably a little bit different than maybe the last time you had a friend over to your house. You didn't anoint their head with oil. The idea of my cup overflows, the goodness and faithful love, only goodness and faithful love will pursue me all the days of my life. I will dwell in the house. So you go from green pastures to the house of God. You see a lot of these conversations that happen in the Psalms. This kind of the way that the psalmist will use language, green pastures, that's obviously outdoors. House of the Lord is indoors. You know, to use that language to talk about who the character of God is, what the character of God is. And there's some beauty in the Psalms with that. Kick over, I'm going to go to Psalm chapter 1 real quick. And I think this will probably wrap it up for us tonight. Maybe I can get to one more after this. I'll do 124 maybe. Notice this, Psalm chapter 1. And this is an interesting psalm because it's an interesting psalm for leading off the book, because it really provides us a doorway to look at the book of Psalms. And notice what it does across these six verses. It doesn't have a title. So immediately, the first two psalms don't have a title. That doesn't really matter to anything. It's just kind of the way that it is. But notice this. How happy. is the one who does not walk in the advice of the wicked, or stand in the pathway of sinners, or sit in the company of mockers. Instead, his delight is in the Lord's instruction, and he meditates on it day and night. He is like a tree planted beside flowing streams that bears fruit, its fruit in its season, and whose leaf does not wither. Whatever he does prospers. The wicked are not like this. Instead, they are like the chaff that the wind blows away. Therefore, the wicked will not stand up in the judgment, nor sinners in the assembly of the righteous. For the Lord watches over the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked leads to ruin. Notice how this is framed out. This here is what we believe is a wisdom psalm. This is talking about how you and how I are can be wise. Notice this is, again, we're talking about wisdom literature this semester. This is very practical instruction on being wise. This is what a wise person looks like, that you walk in the way of the Lord. You happy is the person who does not walk in the advice of the, take the advice of the wicked, or walk in the advice of the wicked, or stand in the pathway of sinners, or sit in the company of mockers. You know, the idea that we get into is that this is the wise way of life. Yahweh, or the Lord God, provides this way of life to those who follow after him. And we see here, this first section that we run into, this deals with the portrait of righteousness. Let's see if I can get my, here we go. The portrait of righteousness is in this first section. Isn't it interesting the way that the author lays this out? Righteousness is understood in terms of what? Initially, opposition to the way of the wicked. People who are wicked, they act this way, they do these things, but the righteous person doesn't do them. The righteous person doesn't walk in the advice of the wicked, doesn't stand in the pathway of sinners, doesn't sit in the company of mockers. And isn't it interesting that you have a de-escalation here? You move from walking with the advice of the wicked, standing in the pathway, to sitting in the company of mockers. But rather, then there's a switch that occurs. His delight is in the Lord's instruction. Now, this is a really critical concept right here. The Lord's instruction. This is going to come up again and again and again throughout the Psalms. We're going to talk about the Lord's instruction again and again and again. It is the word of the Lord. It is these things that you're going to find in these sacred books that comprise the Bible. Now, our instruction might be a little bit more broad in terms of what they would have understood in the immediate context that this was written, it still is the same thing. Psalm 119 talks about the instruction of the Lord. It is the word of the Lord. So right there immediately as we get into the book, we see that it's instructive. And he is like a tree. Now notice this. He is like a tree planted beside flowing streams. This agricultural metaphor right here. One of the things that's beautiful about Psalms is it uses agricultural metaphors like crazy. I mean, you're going to hear about it like this field or that field, this pasture or this stream or this tree or this, you'll see them all out. Because one of the things that we recognize is people understand stories. They understand symbols. They didn't have cars back then. They didn't have pictures. They didn't have computers. They had this. They had the natural world. So you see that again and again. You'll see that it's this idea of bearing fruit in its season, whose leaf does not wither. Whatever he does prospers. That's the first part. And this is the idea of the portrait of righteousness. But then notice what this happens here in verses 4 and 5. If I can get it to do what I want it to do. In verses 4 and 5, we have right here, we have this idea of the portrait of wickedness. So contrasting to the portrait of righteousness is the portrait of wickedness. The wicked are not like this. Instead, they are like the chaff that the wind blows away. Now, what do they mean by the chaff that the wind blows away?
The grain.
We've gotten so far away from an agricultural metaphor, it would do us all a good thing to have a mission trip to a farm. But the reality is that when you're going through and you're dealing with the grain, you throw the grain in the air, the wind comes along and blows away the chaff, and the real grain comes down and lands in a sheet. And it's an easy way nature does it. It's the way God created it to be. And it's just like that, that just as the wind comes through, it'll blow away the wicked, because the wicked don't stand for anything. Does chaff have any value? Nope. But you know what happens when chaff gets mixed in with grain? You mess up grain. That's the truth. I saw a hand, yeah.
My granddad harvested his dried black-eyed peas the same way. You take them, beat them up,
Yeah. Yeah. You were supposed to, every good farmer had a hill. And you'd go to the top of that hill after harvest. You'd throw the grain up and the wind would come through and blow away the chaff. In Judges chapter 6, Gideon is doing the same thing, but he can't do it outdoors because the Midianites have oppressed the people of Israel so much so that they've stolen everything from the people of Israel. Gideon's trying to get his harvest taken care of and trying to kind of keep the grain to himself. And where is he doing it? In a wine press. Yeah, or an olive press. Or a press. We'll just call it a press. So he's going through, and it's a completely different process.
Isn't the chaff like the fiber
Yeah, it is. It's the useless part of the grain. Yeah, and it's that thing. It's when Jesus is going through in the first couple chapters of Mark with his disciples, they take the head off a piece of grain, they rub it in their hands. That helps the chaff get identified, helps work through it, and then you can pick out the grain, the pieces of grain, and you can eat them. He was accused of working on the Sabbath. What's that?
They throw their rice out on the street, and they want you to drive over it to separate the chaff.
There you go. And when you're doing rice harvest as well. So there's a lot of metaphors. It's just challenging. A lot of, particularly folks my age, are just completely unfamiliar with any of these agricultural metaphors. But anyways, and then this last part right down here, verse 6, wraps it up. This is the contrast between the righteous and the wicked. For the Lord watches over the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked leads to ruin. So again, this is how you get in. This is how you open up these Psalms and you dig into them and see what they have. I gave you a couple other illustrations with all of this. Psalm 23. It could be, yeah, the way that it's lined up. There's a couple pieces of parallelism, again, throughout the entire psalm. But I agree, yeah, I agree. I think that's a good observation, Rusty, that it could be that antithetical parallelism. This is one way, this is another way, and so forth, that it works out. We had a couple other psalms, we had a lament psalm, which is in Psalm 60. And then we also had, which it went on for a little while. But then we had a communal song of thanksgiving and so forth. So some of the psalms follow a similar pattern, and you can read a little bit more about that, depending upon what resource you look at with it. The book that we had mentioned that we're using for the kind of as our guiding, Steve and I's guiding method, talks a little bit about this as well. But anyways, to wrap up, we see in the Psalms a great offering of songs, hymns, and other literature testifying to God's beauty and greatness. The diversity of literature allows us to have a pattern of praise that is seen historically but shared communally. And Psalms is a book that shows us worship is diverse and has rich textures. Ultimately, it should draw us to God as worshipers in times good and times that are bad. Psalms provides us with that. How are you worshiping God? How are you engaging with Him? You're going to have good times in your life. You're going to have bad times in your life. You're going to have ripe seasons. You're going to have tough seasons. So, nevertheless, that is where we're going to leave off with Psalms, and then we'll pick up again next week. So, thank you guys for being here, and hope you have a good rest of the evening and a good rest of the week. God bless.